six, seven, eight. What is this? Turn all that off.
I'm gonna shut up.
Explain yourself.
Welcome to One Hour in Life. I'm Alonso Duralde, film critic for therap.com and whattheflick.com.
And I'm Dave White, film critic for movies.com. So you thought I was going to do the impersonation.
A good impersonation of me. Yeah. So, okay, here's the thing. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be going away to Texas.
Yes.
And to help.
And I've already found your substitute.
I know that's where I'm going with this.
Oh, sorry.
To help my family take care of my mom. And I know you have already lined up the eloquent and dapper Mr. James Rocky to help you with this. He's already preparing himself. The past two times I've run into him now at screenings, he starts talking like me, and then he says, Blind Guardian is the better band, but Helloween puts on a great show. Which is true.
I'll take y'all's word for it.
And it occurred to me, because this was my choice of opening introductory music this week, that I've specifically been resisting the playing of really heavy, harsh, metallic stuff.
And I've meant to thank you for that.
And when did you thank me now?
Well, now you've ruined it.
Thank me for the sweet and golden past.
Okay, yes, for the weeks up until now when you have chosen theme music, thank you for not selecting harsh metallic music.
Okay, well, anyway, here's because he's going to come on. And basically talk a lot of metal.
I don't think he's going to do that for the whole show.
No, not for the whole show.
In fact, I will forbid him from
doing it. He's not going to do it for the whole show, obviously. Yeah. But I thought, you know what? Before I leave town, I should, you know, pave the way for him by playing some metal to start the show.
And was that Helloween?
No. those guys, the bands he was talking about are very sort of old school.
No, I know that they're not your kind of.
No, they are my kind, but they are a different kind.
I see.
And they're a kind that I like. They're just not the kind that I tend to be most drawn to. And the kind that I most tend to be drawn to is really, really sludgy, murky, like. The doom sort of, or black metal, or you know, it's anything that sounds fuzzy and raw and gross, and you know, like they might not have the technical skill of a really awesome band like and I'm blanking on the Canadians who I like. I'm a dummy. And I'm gonna remember them in the middle of the show, and then I'm gonna say their name just out of the blue as a non sequitur. But
I'm sure someone at home is already yelling out the name. By the way, it just now occurred to me that I forgot to check our email this week.
This one, anyway, you have just listened to the band called Moss.
All right.
And
tell them how the CD came to the house.
It's not a CD.
Tell them how the cassette came to the house, rather.
In a handmade box. Made of spiky, rusty gears and nails and just, you know, discarded parts of things that have been soldered together. And
wasn't there actual moss in it?
There's still actual moss in it. It lives on a bed of moss in this like 5-pound box that if you threw at another human being, you would kill them. You would die. It's so great. I think they made like 50 of them. This cassette came in an extremely limited edition.
I keep waiting for you to get like heavy metal tetanus.
There are 49 other people in the world who owned the thing that you just heard. That, you know, and I feel very nice when I listen to it. I listen to it when I'm washing dishes a lot. There's sometimes vocals, not often. It's just sort of like, you know,
that's great.
It's what I love. And, yeah, I'm so great.
You're so metal.
I'm so metal right now that I'm about to take a bite of a raspberry Entenmann's Danish. Please start talking so that I can eat some food.
Okay. Gosh, well, so we got quite a few movies to cover this week. And some of them are real good, so that's a nice thing. Cool. You want to start with something good or something crappy?
What was crappy?
The Change Up.
Oh, let's talk about that first.
Okay.
Yeah.
So The Change Up is crappy. it's... You know, I did admittedly laugh a few times, but it tries so hard. This is the Jason Bateman, Ryan Reynolds, button-down lawyer switches bodies with freewheeling bachelor comedy. And it wants to be like raunchy, R-rated comedy, and at the same time sort of sweet movie about, you know, people who learn things about relationships and midlife crises and such. And those two things could be mixed.
Can you hear me chewing in the microphone?
No.
Okay, good.
Those two things could be mixed together by a competent director and a good script.
Who directed this?
David Dobkin, who did The Wedding Crashers.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that was funny.
It was all right. But this one, it just doesn't gel at all.
Yeah. In the first 3 minutes, is maybe poops in Jason Bateman's mouth.
Yes, which for Dave White was the highlight of the film.
It was the best part of the movie. It could have been like a 5-minute movie about a baby pooping in his dad's mouth.
It may have ruined snack pack pudding cups for me for life.
And you would have had a great
short. The next time I peel that lid off, I'm going to be like,
You would have had a great short film about a baby that poops in your mouth. And instead, what they do is they make a 100-minute movie that poops in your mouth. It wasn't even the best baby pooping on a person scene I've ever experienced in a movie. I've been cataloging them. And that award goes to License to Wed, starring Mandy Moore, John Krasinski, and Robin Williams, a film that will possibly actually kill you if you watch it. But put it in your TiVo or your DVR or whatever it is you got.
And do not look directly at any of the rest of the movie.
Do not look directly at any of the rest of the movie, but go to the part where Mandy Moore and John Krasinski are given twin robot babies to take care of as some sort of weird exercise.
It's a marriage encounter kind of.
To prove that they can, like, if only you had to go through these many hoops to get married.
Yeah.
They'll let. I'm sorry. If only straight people had to go through this.
They'll let any straight people do it.
Any lunkhead who, you know,
gets drunk in Vegas.
The opposite sex can go do whatever they want.
Yeah. The world is yours.
Yeah. But so anyway, they give them robot babies. And the robot babies squirt blue poop all over them. Why it's blue? Comedy. And it's the number one baby pooping scene of any film I've ever seen in the entire world.
Well, I'm glad we cleared that up.
Yeah. It's the only thing that redeems that film, watching people get robot baby pooped on that's also blue. So this movie isn't even stupid enough and gross enough to earn that top spot in that. Mostly this movie's just timid, and I don't like movies that are timid.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sick of movies that promise to address sexuality in some way that isn't, you know, within marriage
sexuality,
and blah, blah, blah.
Sex.
Okay, well, that's what I mean. I'm not talking about...
Well, don't be highfalutin about it.
Okay, sorry. Sex, you know. So basically, you know, the whole setup of this movie is, you know...
The posters, the billboards, the bus ads are
exactly.
All like...
It's like
Ryan Reynolds with some chick's feet on his shoulder.
Yeah, exactly.
What are they talking about there?
But does he give her a pap smear? Because, I mean, the premise of the film is basically that, Walking Dead married guy, Jason Bateman, is now suddenly in the body of Swinging Bachelor Ryan Reynolds. Oh, then he's going to sleep with all these women. And, Ryan Reynolds is now in Jason Bateman's body, and he's always lusted after Bateman's wife, Leslie Mann. So now he's going to get to nail her while being in Bateman's body. None of that happens. Nothing like that happens. It's like, what's the point? And you know what? We've had Friends with Benefits and No Strings Attached this year. I would love to have a movie where two young people decide they're going to just like be F buddies and have sex and enjoy it and not get all tied down with emotional, you know, weight, and then actually have that happen. Because it does and it can. But movies never want to be about that. Movies always have to be about true love. You know. And it's
can
like
you say it like that again, please.
True love. Which is fine. It's a thing that happens, but you know, it's not the only thing that happens. It's not the thing that has to happen, and if it doesn't, you're an awful person, which is the subtext of these films. Anyway, I'm an awful person for many reasons, but that's a whole other thing. Anyway, so that's
I'm not an awful person. I'm so great. That's going to be the theme of today's show. I'm so great.
In your head, that's the theme of every show. So I'm just annoyed with these movies that are cowardly is all.
I'm done eating my raspberry Danish. Now the show can start.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're only 11 minutes in, so. You know.
We already talked about a movie. The Change-Up. Body switching. Ta-da.
Burn the Change-Up.
Baby poop in your face, the end. That's what it should be. Fine. So if you ever see this movie on cable, once the baby poops in Jason Bateman's mouth, you're done.
And, you know, one day when Leslie...
You can move on to Cupcake Wars.
When Leslie Mann gets her Life Achievement Award from the American Cinematheque or whatever, you know, they can feature a clip of her in this film because she actually sort of gives this...
She's the only thing that's you know what? I take it back about the baby pooping being the end. She's actually this,
a funny and moving performance that has nothing to do with anything else going on around her. It's like
she woke up one day and was
like, she got a different copy of the script.
Somebody told her, you're going to be in a movie. Judd's not going to be there. Her husband is Judd Apatow. Like, he's not going to be around, but it's his movie. So pretend you're in one of his movies behaving like a normal adult woman. And then she goes and does that.
Even though she gets stuck with this ridiculous role where, like, the two guys sit her down and try to explain to her, oh, we've switched bodies. And, of course, you know, they mess up the whole, she's asking questions that only Jason Bateman would be able to answer, but, you know, they screw that up. And so she's like, oh, you guys are drunk, shut up, blah, blah, blah. And then, like, the very next scene, she's having dinner with Jason Bateman, who is really Ryan Reynolds. And suddenly her husband can't pronounce their daughter's name right and doesn't remember the song that he sings at dinner every night. And it completely just rolls off her back. Like, what's going on here? Like, it doesn't...
5 minutes ago, someone told me something, but I can't remember now what it is.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. It's so, you know, this is written by the guys that did The Hangover, which I know was a huge, huge hit. And you liked it and a lot of people defend it. I didn't like the first Hangover. I didn't like the second Hangover. I don't think these movies are funny. I mean, they have some laughs, but I don't think they're smart enough to be these sort of intricate clockwork bits of, oh, here's all the crazy stuff we did in 8 hours that we don't remember. I think they're both lazy and sloppy movies.
What I think is interesting about the Hangover movies versus this movie is that the Hangover movies exist in a universe that seems to be real, but
yeah,
but. The things that result from all the antics are completely unreal. Mm-hmm. There are zero consequences in the Hangover movies, as we've discussed this before.
Yeah.
But this movie takes place in a magical world where you can have body switching take place at the crack of a you know lightning and a smiling statue and you know a statue that changes facial expressions and
Ryan Reynolds
and the lights all go out
and Ryan Reynolds and Jason Bateman's body not only learns how to be a better person, he learns how to be a lawyer no time.
It exists in this magical world where there are nothing but consequences. Like everything you do is so dangerous that the movie has to prevent you from doing it. So I just think it's really weird that it feels like a movie that got taken away from the writers. You know, like The Hangover feels like a movie where the writers were indulged, you know, to be as
scabrous.
As they wanted to be. And this movie feels like some dumbass studio suit came in and said, oh, no, they have to be super likable from start to finish.
They can't do anything that would make them unsympathetic, so they can't, like, unzip their pants for the entire time.
Because if you're not
going
to make a film that's appealing on any other level except cheap, empty laughs, then please just give me some of those.
Yeah.
And there were some of those.
A few.
In this movie, there were moments when I was laughing, But I don't remember any of them what they were now. Yeah. Like it's been just a few days, and I don't actually remember anything that made me laugh in this movie.
Yeah, me neither. Yeah. It was nice to see Atlanta on film, my hometown.
What of Atlanta did you see, really?
Some skyline shots. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they don't. They that mention means, it.
That makes the room and a the, San Francisco
and
film.
The stadium. They go to the new Fulton County Stadium. You know, which is very nice. It's very it's a very nice facility.
Did they go to the Varsity?
No.
So
you're right. But I just mean a lot of people in Atlanta.
Did they turn the museum into a mental institution? No.
Like yeah.
What did they do that?
Manhunter. Thank you. Yes. So yeah, the change up.
Sucks it.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Okay, moving on. Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Is rad.
Yes. Not a movie that I was particularly looking forward to. It was like I after the Tim Burton debacle, and it was, you know, coming out in August, and I was like, oh well, this is, you know, James Franco, what? It just none of it sounded appealing, none of it sounded like something I wanted to see. And oh my god, it's entertaining.
Yeah. I'm an easy lay with Planet of the Apes, and like when I was a little kid, that was all I cared about. That and the Partridge Family.
Those were your franchises,
pretty much. Yeah.
Those were your lunchboxes.
If those were my lunchboxes, yeah. If I could have, you know,
what would a crossover have been like?
Singing apes.
Like if the Partridge
would singing apes would and it, matching
would,
costumes.
Would it have had to involve the Partridge Family in 2200 AD? Would that have made more sense?
Partridge Family go to the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, I know, but would that...
And the Planet of the Apes are like, you guys are groovy. And then they sing.
You know, they both had cartoons. That would have been the easier way to cross them over.
Yeah.
Yes.
But anyway, I was super obsessed with them as a kid. The kiddie matinees that we talked about a while back. Those were the movies that would play at those kiddie matinees over and over again. And you look at that now and you're like, these are not children's films. Yeah, these are violent movies.
Yeah, we just watched Conquest again.
But they were rated G. They were rated G for general audiences. And so that automatically qualified them to be shown at those kiddie matinees. And they did.
Like, did What's Up Doc show up at the kiddie matinees?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, I saw the Planet of the Apes films, all five of them. Over and over and over and over. Every time they were on TV, I watched them. Every time. Like, it was... I was so into that world.
I remember as a little kid...
I begged
kid,
for the action figures for Christmas. I was committed.
I remember being too young to go to, like... There was some sort of all-day marathon where they were showing... I don't know if it was all five or maybe just three or something. But, like, I remember not being old enough to go, and I was really... ticked about that. But then they would just show on TV all the time. And remember there was that great, that Mad Magazine parody, The Milking of the Planet That Went Ape. Do you remember that one?
No.
Oh, it was great. I actually just found it online and read it again. It's, you know, Mort Drucker. And he really would do like specific moments from a film so well that like,
well, yeah,
you know, which he's such a genius at that kind of thing that like, that now when you go back and see the moment in the film, you think of his version of it practically, you know?
Well, you were more mad. I mean, I've read Mad Magazine when I was a little kid, but I think you read it more obsessively than I did. Yeah, you seem to remember more.
Because I was forbidden to.
You were forbidden to read
it? Oh, my mother would not like
you.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Until I reached a certain age, yes.
How old were you when you got your first one?
Well, see, my parents... I would get them on the sly for my older brothers, but like, I, you know, she would not let me read it like in front of her until I was like 10 or something. I think,
wow, really?
I think she might have seen like a shadow of a so boob you, in one
it,
once
it
and
became
decided
a,
that it was...
So it became forbidden fruit for you, and that's why. Okay.
Naturally.
Yeah, my parents...
were coyotes.
They didn't care. My parents were like, apparently he likes to read books. Let's let him read anything he wants. So... books that were way too old for me, books that were way too grown up for me, I would just pick it up off the shelf in the bookstore and be like, this one. And my parents, my mom or my dad would be like, okay. You know, like, because, you know, you'd go to a store and you would be like, can I get something? And, you know, and I knew, you know, this is a cheap thing. This this is a dollar, basically, or $2 at the most.
Well, were you getting, like, Harold Robbins or something? Really?
No. I was mostly getting books that were just beyond my reading comprehension, but I was determined that I was going to get through them. And I had a little dictionary, and I would look up the words, and I would still not really get them because, they were, you know, I couldn't pronounce them yet, and no adults around me were using those kinds of words. And so I drove my first grade teacher insane because I would constantly go up to her desk and be like, what does this mean? How do you say this? What's this mean? How do you say this? And she would look at me and go, futility. It means that there's no hope. And I'd be like, okay. And then I would go back, you know, to my desk.
But did you read that in Peanuts?
Yeah, I think I did. Yeah. And she said, you know, and I don't know, she probably doesn't remember me at all because it was, you know, 40 years ago, but
she's probably dead.
No, she's not dead. I know because I looked up her and my fourth grade teacher on the internet and they got married.
Oh, right, to each other.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And now they live in Florida. And he's like an author and stuff. Yeah.
Really?
They are still, yeah. And so they're both like in their 70s or whatever, but right. 60s at least. But yeah, I just know that she was this, what is this child about? You know? And so anyway, my parents would just buy me any book and I would just go home and read it. It was only when my oldest brother became a born again Christian that people started policing the things that I was into. Like he would be like, "What are you reading?" And you're like, "Nothing." You know, like
yeah, no, that's like my older brother busted me for reading The World According to Garp when I was like in the 8th grade and he made my parents confiscate it from me. But then the great thing, though, was that my parents, bless them, about 6 to 8 months later, I read it again, and they didn't remember that it was the contraband novel.
My parents never noticed.
My brother wasn't around, so I got to finish it finally.
Yeah. So the I've consumed any media that I felt like at the time, and except for R-rated movies, like those were out of my reach until about 12. But even then, when I was 12, my dad started taking me.
Wow.
To see R-rated movies.
Like Cheaper to Keeper?
No. That was much later. I was 16.
Oh, okay.
I was about 16 when my dad took me to see the Mac Davis film, Cheaper to Keeper.
You're the only person I know who's actually seen that movie.
In a theater, I saw that movie with my father in Clovis, New Mexico.
Oh.
At a twin cinema that was also showing Ordinary People.
Oh, man.
My dad lived across the street from this theater.
Yeah.
And it was a snowy night, and we got back from the movie at about 9, and he's like, "I'm sleepy, I'm going to go to bed." And I was like, "I'm going to walk back across the street and see that other movie." And he's like, "Okay." So I did. I saw Cheaper to Keeper at 7.
With Tova Feltsha.
And then Ordinary People at 9. They are very different films.
Yes.
Yeah. And so...
Are you one of those people that Ordinary People was like really gutting because you grew up in a household of guilt and recrimination?
We can talk about that.
Okay.
Off mic. But
I dated somebody who like had the framed movie poster because he was.
All right. I never had the framed movie poster. I had Devo posters.
Yes.
On my wall. Good sexless American music.
You didn't put Mary Tyler Moore's face on Mark Mother's ball or anything?
No.
Okay.
Where are we going with Cheaper to Keeper? Oh, R-rated movies.
Yes.
The very first R-rated movie my dad took me to see with his girlfriend, Jeanette. I remember this woman because her son was like 4 years older than me and constantly taunting me with issues of Playgirl magazine that his mom would leave on the coffee table. He would hold it up.
It was the 70s.
He would hold it up. She bought Playgirl, and she would keep it on the coffee table because she was a liberated lady. And he would hold up the magazine, let the centerfold drop down, and be like, "Do you like this?" And I'd be like, "No."
Liar.
And I was like 11 or 12. I didn't know what I liked, but I was fascinated by...
You continue to tell the story. I'll do
it. Is the alarm making a noise?
Yes.
Go fix that stuff. No, he would hold it up, and he'd be like, "If you like this, then you're an F." I don't know if I can say that on this show because it's a clean podcast. It's a slur. I think we all know what that F word means. Then you're an F who likes men. You like guys. You like boys. And I'd be like, "I don't. Put it away." You know. So yeah, that was my experience with her. But my dad took us all to see a Peter Sellers movie called Undercover's Hero, which should have been a tip-off.
Yeah.
That this was not going to be Peter Sellers'
the Pink Panther.
Finest hour. It was, I don't remember anything except there were boobs in this movie. It was like a World War II
comedy. It's not one of his better
ones. He played like 7 people and there were lots of naked ladies running around, and it didn't make any sense. And a few weeks later, we went to see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which I was my second R-rated
movie. I got taken to that, too. That was my first R-rated movie.
Well, that was my second one.
Because basically my mom and my sisters went, and they didn't want to leave me at home by myself. So I, you know, at the age of, what, 8 or 9 or something.
Oh, they let you go see R-rated things early.
No, well, they generally didn't. Oh, there was a crackdown on that. But it was just this thing where there was nobody else at home, so they had to take me to see Cuckoo's Nest. Which is not appropriate
That's a
for children.
Grown-up movie.
Yeah. And then a couple of years later, I remember I went out with my sibs, and we were going to go see Rocky, and it sold out. And so we went to the other movie, which was Network.
Nice.
So those were my first two R-rated movies. And then I remember later, I was able, even though I was still too young, I was able to talk my siblings into taking me to World According to Garp and Ordinary People because I'd read the books.
Of course.
And then I snuck into Conan the Barbarian. That was the first R-rated movie that I went to, you know.
They get down in that movie.
On the sly. Yeah, well, yep. I had read the comics, so I wanted to see the movie.
What else? We are off track.
Rise of the Planet of the Apes is how this all started.
What I like about this movie is that it's got all the trappings of science fiction. That whole sort of like, man tampers with nature and blah, blah, blah.
Right, right.
But it's really not about anything. It's just about apes taking over the world.
Not so much, yeah.
There's no analogy. There's no metaphor. There's no, like, I'm commenting on the genetic, you know.
It's sort of like, how can we use sort of contemporary science as a way to explain how apes take over the world? Yeah, and they do that pretty well, actually.
X equals X, and it's
as far as setting up the plot mechanisms of how the humans get wiped out and the apes become super smart. It does. It covers its bases.
It's totally fun. Andy Serkis is great.
Yes.
It's really tense and awesome because it's directed by the guy who made The Escapist, which is this great British prison break movie.
Which if you didn't see, you should totally
go get that and see it. That'll be my DVD recommendation of the week because I don't have anything on my mind other than finishing up this podcast so that I can start making pancakes. It's Sunday morning. I'm fixing to make some pancakes for some friends who are coming over because... our nephew, Carlos, is here living with us all summer long, and he's going to ask entertainment industry people questions about the entertainment industry.
Right.
Because we don't have any answers.
Exactly.
Because we are not actually part of the entertainment industry.
We are the barnacles on the edge.
We just look at it and write about it.
We point and laugh.
And but he's actually going into this, and he's doing an internship and blah, blah, blah. So... yeah, we're bribing our friends who work in the industry with pancakes so that they will answer
a young college student's question. Yeah. Okay, so we're
don't you wish you were our nephew? Everyone out there, don't you wish that you were?
If we're talking about, I'll go ahead and do my DVD recommendation. I should have mentioned it earlier because it actually ties into Leslie Mann, the one bright spot of the change-up. I was reminded that one of her early films is a movie that I like a lot that I screened back in Dallas in the days when I was running the USA Film Festival. It is on DVD, although it's really hard to find. Like, I got a copy from Amazon, and it's a tiny company, and I don't know, like, if you're ever going to find it on Netflix or whatever. But it's called Things I Never Told You, and it is...
I don't remember that.
It's from the Spanish director Isabel Quaché, who did Elegy a couple years ago with that great movie with Penelope
Cruz.
You're
so good at saying Spanish things.
Imagine. With Penelope Cruz and Ben Kingsley, and she did My Life Without Me, not a movie I was crazy about, with Sarah Polley. Anyway, Things I Never Told You stars Lily Taylor and Andrew McCarthy, and it's...
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah, and it's a really kind
chocolate
of...
Chocolate Chip.
Yes, yeah. It's a really cool romantic comedy. But it's,
I don't remember it being a romantic
it's not
comedy.
Really, yeah, it's not really... I mean, it's almost a romantic drama, I guess. It's kind of a sad movie, but it also has some laughs in it and some uplift. And it's got this amazing supporting cast, including Debbie Mazar and Richard Edson, and a very young, early in her career, Leslie Mann. So, Things I Never Told You, worth checking out.
What else are we talking about? Are we done talking
we're
about
done
apes?
With apes?
I mean, there's
yeah,
nothing
apes is great. Go see it. Okay, let's talk about my favorite film of 2011 so far, which is...
Attack the Block.
Attack the Block, and it's showing in about 8 cities right now.
Is that that many? Because I'm surprised, because I talk to people, and they're like, I don't even know what this movie is.
Well, people in L.A. don't even know that it opened. There's been so little fanfare about it. But, it's... So crazy fun. It's written directed by this guy, Joe Cornish. It's his first film. He's now like you know, Edgar Wright executive produced the movie, and now Wright and Cornish, I think, co-wrote the Tintin movie that's coming out at the end of the year. And it's basically about an alien invasion that takes place entirely within a South London council flat block. And it starts out with this sort of gang of marauding teenagers who mug a nurse. And so off the bat, you're like, oh, well, I hate these little beasts. And they wind up being the only ones who can sort of fight the aliens, and they have to team up with the nurse to do it. And by the end of the movie, you're totally on their side. And they speak in a nearly impenetrable, like, South London patois brava. But it doesn't matter. I missed about 60% of what they actually said, and I still totally followed the story. Nick Frost is probably about the only name in it that you'll recognize.
He is the only name.
But it's just funny and charming and scary.
Charming is not the right word.
I was charmed by it. I mean, in that it took these characters that I originally found despicable and made them all kind of, you know, lovable.
Oh, they charmed you.
Yes.
Okay.
But, you know, it's tense and it's scary.
They don't do it in ways that are traditionally charming.
No.
Right.
And it's, I'll tell you, you know, when I saw Cowboys and Aliens, I was like, well, that was okay. It was, meh. And, you know, Dave was saying that the further away from it, the more he decided that movie was garbage. I am now on I'm now on that page, because after seeing Attack the Block, it's like, no, this is how you do one of these movies. You have characters that matter. You have suspense. You have cool monsters that don't look like CG creations. And
don't look like H.R. Geiger drawings.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And aren't slimy and gooey, and which is just a typical
way
to make a monster.
This movie's just, it's fresh and it's great. And it gave me a great deal of pleasure. And so
I want to see it again.
I will totally go see it again.
I want to see it again. I really liked how, without even letting you know that it was, that it's actually sort of like a political kind of film too as well. And about, you know, the poverty and
race and
everything.
The inner city.
That happens to people who are stuck in a certain geographical area of a city. Whether they, you know, in the eyes of other people, belong there or not.
Right. And what they're
forced, the specific things that befall them.
And what they're forced to contend with, not only without the help of the authorities, but with the authorities actively working against them.
And so I thought that was a really interesting way
to
put that in the film. And because they do. Because if, I don't know if you, we'd have to talk about this off mic because I don't want to spoil it, but near the end when the thing that he's climbing up to get back to.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, that's the most obvious visual symbol of it in the movie. And again, we're speaking in code now, so we'll stop. But it's so exciting and so, you know, so cheap and dirty and, you know, fresh that even if you don't get the whole, you know, bruv, you know, even if you don't get what they're saying, you need, you know, captions when the DVD comes out, go ahead and use them.
Yeah. It's exhilarating.
It's pretty great.
So go see it. Also out this week in limited release, opening in New York and Los Angeles, but expanding in the coming weeks, is Bellflower, which played at the Sundance and South by Southwest festivals and is getting a lot of word of mouth and a lot of very polarizing word of mouth, I would say.
That, really polarizing?
Yeah, there are people that love it, and there are people who think it's misogynist or that, you know.
No, it's not.
I wouldn't go that far either. But
that's because people don't understand that there's a difference between what your characters do and what your film is doing.
I would say that for me, there did feel an occasional blurring of, you know, not so much, I wouldn't say misogyny, but definitely the whole notion of, like, the masculine panic that sort of suffuses the movie.
That's what the movie's about.
Right, but I'm not entirely sure that it's not also present in the mind of the filmmaker. I mean, not just that he's making a movie about it, but that he's got it himself. To me, it felt there was a blur.
That makes for a very personal movie, and that's what this is.
Yeah.
It's about a guy who is kind of a dirtbag, and he hangs with other dirtbags.
He falls for
a dirtbag girl.
He and his best friend are obsessed with Mad Max, and they basically spend all their time preparing for the apocalypse by like building an amazing muscle
building
car.
Building awesome things.
And a flamethrower.
I want a flamethrower now
I'm
that
sure
I've seen
you
this
do.
Movie.
I knew you were going to ask for one.
Sometimes I need a movie to remind me that I need the best weaponry available to mankind. The Strangers made me understand that I need an M16.
Yeah, no, that's not
this movie means that I need a flamethrower. I need both of those things to help protect me against marauders, people who wear bags over their head, and you, should you ever do me wrong.
Yeah, perhaps your next husband will allow you to do those things, because this one is not.
I love this movie because it's... Okay, maybe love is the wrong word. I super like this movie as a friend. Because I go back to The Change-Up and every other movie about dumb guys walking around in a state of male pattern anxiety-ness and freaking out about their place in the world, freaking out about their lack of power, being emasculated by this or that or whatever. And the movies that those movies are never address what's really going on in the film, especially these comedies that are happening.
But at the same time, they never address it. At the same time, though, I think this movie kind of
they're just examples of it.
This movie kind of lets its protagonist off the hook in that he's always the victim of things that are being done, and he doesn't get called on stuff that he does that's kind of jerky.
Kind of jerky? He does tons of jerky stuff. So he's more than kind of jerky. And no, the movie allows him to walk through all this, you know, carnage and come out of it.
But at the same time, when jerky stuff is done to him, it's like, oh, the worst thing ever.
Well, yeah. Yes. You know. And there's an element in this film of judgment about him. It doesn't let him off the hook in terms of the film's attitude toward him.
Hmm.
Again, the character walks through this stuff. I wouldn't say unscathed,
no,
but I would say that the movie itself is not saying this guy's a hero for doing all the things that he's done.
No, but I think you're intended to feel a certain
degree
of sympathy.
It's incredibly violent, is what we're talking about here, and it's violence committed against him him.
Yeah,
everyone around him is involved in some sort of horrific activity.
Yes. I would definitely recommend the film. I think it's a movie that people should see because it has a really cool look to it. The director,
it looks amazing.
Yeah, Evan Gliddell, the director and star and writer and everything else, is a cinematographer. Like,
it looks grimy and just color saturated.
He's worked as a DP for years, and he actually created a camera for this movie.
Yeah.
And he created this car that does all the stuff that car in the movie is supposed to do. And he made the flamethrower and all that. It's a movie worth seeing. I think this guy is going to be an interesting, you know, sort of indie guy to watch.
Well, I hope he stays interesting. I don't want Hollywood to come in and say, here's, you know, $20 million.
To make the Change-Up
2. Please direct Smurfs 2.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, I hope that he keeps it real, man. But, yeah. There's some good supporting cast members, and there's a lot to like about this movie. So I have some issues with it, but nothing so major that I would say don't go see it. You should totally go see it and support this film.
Do not play a drinking game with the word dude.
Or awesome.
Or awesome, because
you will get liver poisoning.
Yeah, it is the most dude-filled movie.
Since Dude Wears My Car.
Since Dude Wears My Car, yes. Thank you. Thank you for that. I should have used that in my review. Why didn't you make that joke earlier?
I hadn't thought of it. But yeah, no. So it's a movie worth checking out, and you know, you'll have discussions about it because I think it's like I said, it's rubbing.
Or you will just go get a flamethrower.
Or you'll get a flamethrower.
I don't need to talk anymore about this movie. I just need a flamethrower.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Last thing we wanted to talk about is a documentary that it's opened in New York, and I don't know what its expansion plans are.
Is it like playing now in New York?
I think it might have already come and gone in New York. I don't really know.
Did it play in Los Angeles?
Yeah. I don't know that it has, but...
You start talking about it, and I'm going to look up information.
It's a documentary called El Bulli. What's the subtitle? The science of the cooking or something? Anyway, it's a documentary about El Bulli, which is this sort of legendary restaurant in Barcelona, where they kind of where molecular gastronomy was sort of invented.
El Bulli, cooking in progress.
Cooking in progress.
Two words: ELBULLI.
Right.
Yeah.
And this restaurant would actually close for 6 months out of the year to invent new dishes that they would then serve the other 6 months of the year, and so. It's a very kind of fly on the wall documentary. There's no narration. There's no interviews. It's just sort of observation. You know, it's very Frederick Wiseman style of these chefs, you know, who are sort of all scientists, basically, because everything they're doing involves, you know, liquid nitrogen in these scales and you know, just crazy infusions of air and water and oils and whatever. And just, you know, it's like Signe Chanel, like, where you're watching them create a couture line. Here you're watching them create this menu that's going to happen for the next 6 months of this
restaurant. This pork chop is now a piece of cellophane.
Exactly.
Put it in your mouth.
And El Bulli is now, apparently they've closed the restaurant. It is now like a lab
full-time,
you know, so you can't even eat there anymore. But yeah, I mean, I've never eaten molecular gastronomy.
Food's so conceptual, you're not even allowed to eat it.
Exactly. It exists in another plane. It's the idea of food. I've never eaten molecular gastronomy. I've never gone to one of the restaurants.
You did last night. What are you talking about?
Okay, well, we'll get to that. But generally speaking, it's not something that I've never sat down for a full meal of it, and so I haven't completely wrapped my head around the concept. But the documentary has made me interested in it because it's a fascinating
the
film.
The friends who came over last night to watch this movie
are big foodies.
Brought like in a, not in a way like, oh, we just like to eat, but like they go to like fancy restaurants and they the guy who brought over who came the guy and his girlfriend who came over last night,
he brought his own sous vide.
His own sous vide with him. And that is
it's kind of a
it looks like a big blue box.
Yeah, it's sort of a slow cooker that uses water, but the thing is that it gets water to exact temperatures. And so, you know, usually what you do with these with your food is you vacuum seal. Like he said, they'd made like a salmon with lemon stuff. So you would take like the salmon, you would take the slices of lemon, and you would vacuum seal it into a bag. And then you put the bag in the sous vide, and then you cook it at this precise temperature for however long. Yada, yada. So last night he made these eggs, because apparently at 141 degrees, the yolk stays liquid.
Soft.
And at 143 degrees.
So does the white.
Yeah. And at 143 degrees, the yolk becomes solid. But at 142, it becomes this sort of congealy halfway thing.
You just tap a hole in the egg and pour it out into a cup and eat it with these chips.
And it's custardy, you know.
Yeah.
So he made these 142-degree eggs.
I ate a 142-degree egg last night.
With these pita chips that he made in the oven with this, like, smoky salt. And it was really delicious.
We ate it while we watched this.
But that is not remotely as bizarre as the stuff
they're making.
The movie, they're making stuff like gorgonzola bubbles and ice lake, you know, which is like this sort of – it's a bowl. With kind of an ice sheet over the top, and the ice
is a sheet of sugar ice or something.
No, it's plain ice, but then it's covered with like sugar and lime, and you crack it with a spoon and you eat the ice with the sugar and lime on. No, sorry, sugar and mint on top.
It's
all this sort of conceptual food. It's crazy, but it's really interesting to see how into it these people are and how seriously they take it and the whole sort of trial and error process. And you know, one of the things is this sort of like it's a ravioli without the pasta, so it's basically sort of like ravioli in some sort of pouch.
It's an edible pouch that just melts.
Yeah, you know, that you sort of dunk it and it collapses in your mouth or whatever. And I told Dave, it reminded me of this artist that he's a fan of, this British artist. What's her
name?
You
keep bringing her up. Rachel Whiteread.
Rachel Whiteread, because she famously would sort of cast negative spaces.
She resin casts negative space.
Like she took an abandoned water tower, filled it with resin, and then took the water tower away. Right. And so she had this resin cast of what the inside.
She's done it with mattresses, with the insides of a home. Like famously she did the inside of a house.
Yeah.
In England, and then they took the house off.
So just the idea of a ravioli
made people mad.
The idea of a ravioli that doesn't have any pasta, that's just the inside, that's somehow being magically held together as a shape that you then eat, just reminded me of the negative space thing.
And the movie itself is really fascinating to watch, because these guys move like monks. Like little like quiet scientists, and they do all these like weird things to everything.
You'd think it
the machinery that they employ to make this stuff.
It's like watching Robert Oppenheimer create the A-bomb, you know? but they're
Los Alamos of food.
Yes.
So it's totally interesting. It's called El Bulli. Cooking in progress. They've got a Facebook page. I just found it.
Oh, okay, cool.
But I can't find out where else it's playing or if it is playing anywhere else except New York. But it'll a movie like this, it'll eventually just be on DVD in about 6 months or yeah. so. So, you know.
Be on the lookout.
Put it on your list because it's very cool.
If you're remotely interested in food and what's happening, how it happens and what happens next.
Futuristic food.
The future of food, totally.
All right, we're done.
Yeah, God, we had 5 movies. I didn't think we'd get.
You got to go to the grocery store.
Okay, yes,
bacon,
yes.
I need cranberry
okay,
juice.
Okay, yes, I'm on
I
it.
Need 2 pounds of butter.
Want
we're
to
out of vanilla?
All right, thank
need
you.
A half a gallon of buttermilk.
Okay, stop.
A dozen eggs.
Stop talking. We want to.
I made a list.
Thank you all for listening. Please tell your friends about the show, and if you haven't already, leave us a review on iTunes. Those always help, and we appreciate the folks who've done it already.
I've already checked out of this podcast.
You can visit.
I'm going to go molecularly make a pancake.
You can visit our Facebook page, Linoleum Life Podcast. Our Twitter account is Linoleum Cast. And, of course, we urge you to check out our friends in podcast land, The Popcorn Mafia, which I was the last-minute surprise guest star on this week, which was a lot of fun. Thank you, Gray. The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli. Blowhard, Podcast, Criterion Cast, Fat Guys at the Movies, Secretly Timid, Glitter in the Garbage. We'll be around next week, so join us then, and thanks for listening.
Goodbye.